From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the August 2019 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast. 90 days. In earlier episodes this year, we've concentrated on the preparations for and the events of D-Day itself, the 6th of June. However, D-Day was only the beginning of the Normandy campaign. The Allies had to face an enemy determined to throw them back into the sea, and it led to some of the bitterest fighting that Western Europe saw in World War II. It would eventually, after 3 months, end in a massive victory for the Allies and the liberation of Paris at the end of August 1944. In this It Happened Here episode, we see how Bletchley Park continued to contribute to Allied success. We'll find out how the nature of this contribution changed from one of supporting the planning of future operations to one of supporting an ongoing battle. Bletchley Park's research officer, Thomas Cheetham, has been exploring the role of ultra-intelligence in this crucial campaign.
This is Bletchley Park. It happened here.
With the recent 75th anniversary of D-Day, with these podcasts, we've been looking a lot at D-Day itself as one day. A lot of people might maybe just think that that's it, it's one single day. Can you tell us what came after?
The landings themselves are only the start of a campaign that would last for several months. The seaborne invasion is known as Operation Neptune, and at the end of D-Day, it's seen 156,000 Allied troops put ashore in Normandy. But this is only the opening part of Operation Overlord, which is the overall invasion of Europe. Neptune, because it's a naval component, continues technically, I think, until the middle of June. But Overlord goes through right to the liberation of Paris. On D-Day itself, the German response had been weak. We tend to remember D-Day as an event where the landed troops overcame heavy odds to achieve their objectives. And to the individuals on the ground, they definitely did have a difficult time. But while the Germans had strong defences, and they had all the advantages from being on the defensive, their troops on the day were second rate. They had limited tank support and they had virtually no air support. Field Marshal Rommel believed it was imperative to counterattack the beaches as soon as possible after a landing took place. But in the event, the only major counterattack of the day by 21st Panzer Division came to nothing. It was launched late in the day. It was beaten back with relative ease because the British armour coming off Sword Beach is able to take up positions. They expect a counterattack. The counterattack emerges and they beat it back.
So the Allies are significantly stronger than the Germans?
They have more troops on the ground. They're better equipped. This doesn't make it an easy operation. The point is, even with all the massive air support, massive naval superiority, a very precisely planned operation, the whole landing could still have fallen apart because you're combining two of the most difficult military operations, a seaborne landing and fighting in a built-up area, on one day. As David's talked about in previous episodes and we've covered in events across the site, Bletchley Park played a really important role in guaranteeing the success of the operation.
So moving from Neptune to focusing on Overlord then?
The plan is to make it to Paris in 90 days and to establish a solid foothold on the continent from which further operations can unfold. The expectation from the Allied commanders is that the Germans won't fight for the beachhead for too long because they hold none of the cards. They'll be at the mercy of naval gunfire, which can be devastating. So they expect them to fall back to a line on the River Seine and defend further inland.
You said on D-Day the Germans had second-rate troops. They had certain disadvantages. Was that the case as the Allies moved forward?
Well, as the campaign unfolds, the Germans are able to bring in forces from across France and also from the Eastern Front. And in contrast to the troops who were actually present on D-Day, many of them are first-rate divisions, especially the SS Panzer divisions, which are well-trained, well-equipped, but also fanatical fighters. So they represent a much tougher proposition for the Allied forces. And the campaign would unfold into quite a gruelling fight, and over time the Germans would correct many of the deficiencies they suffered with on D-Day, and it would become a much fairer fight in many ways.
The Allies were a multinational force. How were they split in the field? Did they have different objectives, for example?
Yes, so the Americans have landed further to the west, and their objective is to capture the Kotentin Peninsula. At the tip of the peninsula is the port of Cherbourg, and that's the major port in the area, which the Allies hope to capture relatively quickly because that will increase the amount of supplies they can bring ashore considerably. So the first American objective is to cut the Kotentin off and stop any German reinforcements reaching Cherbourg and then capture the city before pushing south. The British in the east, along with the Canadians, have the objective of the city of Caen, which is the largest city in Normandy. If they capture it, they can break out into the open country to the south. They plan to capture Caen on D-Day, but failed ultimately, and that would form a really tough position for them to take and a really easy defensive position for the Germans to congeal around. The main concern for the Germans is to form a tough defence around Caen and do what they can for Cherbourg, but they're more worried about Caen because it's further to the east. And if they leave that flank open, the Allies could just drive straight to Paris.
Back in the English Channel, great convoys of troops and reinforcements continued to move toward the beaches of Normandy. The beachhead already had expanded to 50 miles, and they put ashore the complete equipment of a highly mechanized army. Among those witnessing the beachhead operation was the Supreme Allied Commander, General Eisenhower. Here he meets with Admiral Ramsay, Chief of Naval Operations, and with Britain's great soldier, General Montgomery. The Supreme Commander is on hand to learn firsthand how the offensive is going. What he learned was good indeed. The meeting of these brilliant leaders symbolizes the unity of the United Nations forces they represent. The Allies have found firm resistance and are prepared for even stronger contests. Less than a week after the initial landings, we had taken 10,000 prisoners. There is much hard fighting ahead, but the Germans are now faced with a three-front war. In the northern reaches of Russia, in the mountains of Italy, and here against this most tremendous military operation in history.
Many of our episodes have looked at D-Day itself and Bletchley Park's role in the planning of D-Day beforehand. Did Bletchley Park's role change as the move into Normandy progressed?
So that role continues, but it is possible to use ultra intelligence in a more tactical way. By this stage, all intelligence coming out of Bletchley Park based on high-grade German ciphers, so Enigma and Lorenz, is called Ultra. Earlier on, it was a code name for the intelligence sent directly to the Allied commanders, but by this point, the term's broadened out somewhat.
And after D-Day, the use of it changed?
Well, there's obviously the potential with troops on the ground in contact to influence the battle in quite a direct way in certain circumstances. So, for example, as I mentioned, the Germans know the importance of an armoured counterattack in defeating the invasion, and they start putting plans in place pretty quickly. And the formation, which is in charge of the German armoured reserve in the west, is Panzergruppe West. They move their headquarters closer to the front line to prepare a counterstroke that's planned for the 10th or 11th of June. Bletchley Park are able to pinpoint this headquarters using a combination of ultra messages, but also direction finding and traffic analysis. And the RAF launch a bombing raid, which destroys the headquarters. It wounds the head of Panzergruppe West, who's Georg von Schweppenberg, and it kills many of his staff. So that formation is not able to do anything for the few days afterwards. It has to go back to Paris to regroup. Its subordinate units are parceled off to different German formations, and the counterattack doesn't emerge in the end. There's indications that those armoured units would probably have to be committed to the front line to just shore back the Allies anyway, but it certainly doesn't hurt to knock out a German headquarters like that.
So ultra intelligence is contributing to the Allies' ability to identify and locate German forces, for example.
Absolutely. Just like before the invasion, they're able to work out where the Germans are. Most of the time, this is only supplementing intelligence that's coming from the troops on the ground. Because when you're in contact with the enemy, you can conduct patrolling, you can capture prisoners, you can do reconnaissance on a very intimate level. There is also tactical signals intelligence going on. Tactical Y units attached to the Allied armies are intercepting communications on the battlefield, and they're adding to the intelligence picture. And they are not part of the Bletchley Park operation. They're taking advice from Bletchley Park on matters of cryptography and traffic analysis, but they are a separate organisation doing their own work.
When we're talking about ultra-intelligence, what did the intelligence product look like? How was it disseminated and spread?
So when intelligence comes out of Hut 6, having been decrypted, and it goes into Hut 3, where its intelligence usefulness is assessed, messages are placed in certain levels of priority. If a message is particularly important or a piece of intelligence is particularly important, it's expedited out to the Allied commands as soon as possible in the form of a headline. It isn't a verbatim transcript of the message, it's just the gist of it. But the important thing is to get that information to the Allied commanders as quickly as possible. an organisation has been put in place to handle this intelligence flow. What you have is SCUs and SLUs, special communications units attached to the Allied commands, and they work with special liaison units, which actually hand the intelligence over. So the special communications units run the signals equipment. The messages are encrypted at Bletchley Park before they're sent overseas. The special communications unit decrypts the message at the Allied headquarters, hand it over to the special liaison unit, and they let the Allied commanders know what's happening. As well as going to the Allied commanders in the field, the intelligence is also being disseminated to every other level of the Allied command and the whole intelligence structure, dependent on the priority of the information. And on top of that, less urgent intelligence is being disseminated to the ministries and to the higher commands.
And there are summary reports going around Bletchley Park as well.
There's a section called Intelligence Exchange, which is tasked with collating all the intelligence from across the park and issuing it in reports to let everyone basically know what the other sections are working on. The regular codebreakers wouldn't obviously have access to that information, but the higher-ups, the heads of the sections, would.
Am I right in thinking we still have those reports today?
Yes, so I was looking at some of these just the other day in the archive, and they're really interesting because they give us a really good overview of all the intelligence that's being produced at this time in just a few pages. After D-Day, Intelligence Exchange issues what they call special summary reports. The intelligence they contain lags somewhat behind the normal intelligence loop, but you do get a really good picture of what's coming out of Bletchley Park at that time.
The curé of this little Normandy church, 2 or 3 miles from Caen, wants me to say how sorry he is about these bells. His village has only just been liberated, and it's taken until yesterday to clean up the many German snipers left in hiding. When I asked the curé if we might record the bells of his church ringing in celebration of the village's freedom, he asked me to wait for a week. And this is why. They used to have a very lovely little carillon in this church. Only 3 bells, but they were very proud of it, and many of the villagers were expert bell ringers. But when the Allies freed the village, 3 German snipers hid in the square tower of the church, and for 2 nights they were very troublesome. At last they gave themselves up, but it was found that they had smashed the big bell of the carillon. Monsieur le Curé promised that if I would only wait a week, he would have the big bell repaired and you could hear the full carillon. But he added that in any case, they were going to ring the remaining 2 bells at once this morning to celebrate our coming. And I thought that you would rather hear the bells now, even though the big one has been smashed by the Germans, to let you know that the people of Normandy are celebrating their liberation. The church bells are ringing, and the villagers are going to mass to give thanks for their freedom.
Can you give us an example of the kind of intelligence that we're talking about here?
A really good example is the Battle of Carentan, which takes place a few days after D-Day. The town itself is the link up between Utah Beach and Omaha Beach, so it's vital to secure it. The Germans know it's vital to hold it. And the US 101st Airborne Division takes Carentan on the 12th of June. If you've ever seen Band of Brothers, you will have seen a depiction of that battle. Bletchley Park was monitoring the German forces moving from the centre of France to Normandy, and one of these units was 17th SS Panzergrenadier Division. It was discovered on 7th of June that it was moving north towards the front line. And this was actually, interestingly enough, this was on Puffin, which was a German army key used in Italy, which David mentioned in last month's episode. So that gives you a really good indication of how important it is to draw the whole picture together, because intelligence from one front can actually inform completely different ones. It was known by the evening of 11th of June that 17th SS was southwest of Carentan, so it's poised to interfere with the Allied operations. And this was on the red key used by the German Air Force. A lot of the important keys at this stage are not army keys, but they are Air Force keys.
Why is that? Why is the information coming through on the Air Force key?
They tend to be easier to read and they carry a lot of intelligence about what the army is doing, because the German army are in touch with the German Air Force asking for air support. There is a structure in place for coordinating the actions of the Air Force and the army. And that's carrying information about where German units are, because if the Air Force don't know where they are, they might bomb them. A great deal of that traffic is being read.
So this division on the 11th of June, they're near Carentan.
Yes. And the next morning, Bletchley Park read orders for 17th SS to attack towards Carentan that very morning. This had the potential to be very dangerous, since the 506 Parachute Infantry Regiment of 101st Airborne had circled south of the town and it was attacking north into the town. And this meant that if the Germans attacked at that point, they'd catch them in the rear. And that could be an extremely dangerous position. These are lightly armed paratroopers. They don't have anti-tank guns or any armoured support. And the Germans do have armoured support. Fortunately, the German attack is postponed due to logistic difficulties because they've had so much difficulty moving towards the front line with constant Allied air attacks that they're not in position to launch the counterattack as they planned. The delay in the German attack gives the Americans time to react, and they bring elements of the 2nd Armored Division, which had just come off Omaha Beach, to reinforce the paratroopers, who arrive just in the nick of time. The Germans do attack. They push them back some distance, but they don't get near the town because American armor is able to push the Germans back and save the situation.
Jerry's reaction to our breakthrough was to counterattack. Was fighting, street by street, house to house, hand to hand. We were in it up to our necks, slugging it out with the Germans at Carentan. But we smashed it. And how?
Was Bletchley Park reading all about this in the signals traffic then? Was it sort of as it was happening?
Yes, so because the Germans tried to arrange for air support, in the end, I don't think they get it. But Bletchley Park is able to read the message requesting that, and they're able to read the plans for the attack. And because it's delayed by a day, there's time for that intelligence to make its way to the American commander, General Bradley, who's able to bring the armoured forces up.
If there hadn't been that delay, would they have been reading it too late?
Yes, that's essentially what this is. And this is the problem with much of the ultra-intelligence. It's just not quite fast enough to keep up with events on the ground because attacks are being planned in the space of a day or maybe even just a few hours. And it's just not fast enough to intercept, decrypt, analyse, and then get that intelligence over to the Allied commands. Tactical intelligence on the ground being carried out in the battle area is just quicker.
We know, for example, on D-Day, we've been talking about situations where Bletchley Park was able to read these messages really, really quickly and turn around very swiftly and send information back out to the front. That just wasn't sustainable then during the ongoing Battle of Normandy.
Yeah, at the end of the day, Bletchley Park aren't reading the Army Air Force keys as quickly as they are reading the naval keys on D-Day. They don't have the same apparatus set up. They don't have interceptors on the site at Bletchley. And they're having to juggle a lot of traffic and make decisions about what's higher priority and what's lower priority. And this slows down the system. It's still a very impressive task to turn over the intelligence in a day or two as they do, but it's just not quite fast enough to keep up with the ongoing progress of the battle.
So did they have to make decisions to drop certain things or to overlook certain things in favour of other messages, other traffic links and so on?
Yeah, it's always a balance between the quality of the intelligence and the ease of interception and decryption. And HUT-6 are telling their Y stations what they need to intercept, and then HUT-3 are telling HUT-6 what intelligence they want decrypted quicker. This is an ongoing process. This is not just unique to D-Day. This is what Bletchley Park have been doing since early 1940, making these decisions about what's important and what isn't. They're only reading a fraction of the German traffic. Around the time of D-Day, there's about 60 German keys which are known of, and daily about 20 of those are attacked. And that gives you a certain amount of intelligence, of which about 10% is sent as high priority to the Allied commanders. So it's only a tiny fraction of what's out there in the airwaves. The important thing to realise is that even that tiny fraction can be very important and can make a material difference to the intelligence picture and the outcome of the campaign.
Were there specific networks that they were breaking more frequently?
Yes, the German Air Force networks and the Air Force Army liaison keys are always useful because they're relatively easy to break and they carry useful information about where army units are and what they're doing. So the decrypts which most assisted in the Battle of Carentan were on a key called Ocelot, which is used by what were called FLIVOs, a German Air Force liaison officers who were coordinating air support. Luckily, Bletchley Park had only begun reading Ocelot on the 8th of June, so just in the nick of time for that intelligence to be captured.
And that's an Enigma.
And that's an Enigma system, yeah. And there were various other Air Force keys reporting on the land fighting. There were paratroop units involved in the Battle of Normandy and flak units who were on the Luftwaffe networks. So overall, 15 Luftwaffe keys were read during the Battle of Normandy. And on 9th of June, that accounted for 2,936 messages.
4 years after to the day, General de Gaulle returns to France. Nothing could do more to encourage the French people than a visit to liberated territory by the man who has done so much to uphold the spirit of resistance in his country. This is indeed an historic occasion, and one full of portent for the people of France.
The old Norman town of Bayeux, the first place of any size to be liberated by the Allies, gives him an ardent greeting. In the words of correspondents on the spot, General de Gaulle moved in an atmosphere of intense fervor. He walked through the streets followed by a great throng of admiring citizens. Speaking with noticeable emotion, General de Gaulle saluted the liberated town of Bayeux in the name of the government of France. 2 days later, the King made a surprise visit to the Normandy beaches. General Montgomery, the commander-in-chief, is there to welcome His Majesty and escort him to 21st Army Group headquarters. Here indeed was convincing proof of our solid lodgment in France. It was during this momentous visit that the King held an investiture in the field. The first officer to be decorated was the commander of the 3rd Canadian Division, which has been in the thickest of the fighting all the way from the beaches. From the men formed up on three sides of a square on the overgrown lawn, there comes a burst of cheering. It was a day to be remembered.
Was Enigma becoming more complex? Were the codebreakers pretty familiar with how to break Enigma at this point?
The codebreakers are pretty familiar with it, but it is becoming more complex. The Germans, throughout 1944, bring in various improvements to their cipher security. And it's lucky that none of these are brought in before the 6th of June. The problem gets progressively harder and harder from 6th of June onwards.
Why is that?
I think it's just coincidence, as far as I've been able to work out. Some of these changes are long overdue, and it's just luck that they happen to fall shortly after D-Day takes place.
What sort of changes?
Earlier in 1944, the Germans had introduced a rewirable reflector to their Air Force Enigmas. So everybody's heard of the Enigma rotors. It has three rotors, then the signal passes through the rotors and they scramble it. After the rotors, there's an element called the reflector, which sends a signal back through the rotors again. And that's how the machine is able to be reciprocal. And that's why you can decrypt a message at the other end by setting up the machine in exactly the same way as the original operator. By being able to rewire the reflector quite quickly, that's something that Bletchley Park has to work out several times a month before they can read those keys.
So they changed the machine rather than maybe changing how they use the machine?
Yeah, it's literally the wiring inside the machine that they're able to change. And this reflector can literally be opened up, rewired in the field with minimal tools, and then plugged back into the machine. Further problems with the Air Force keys are caused in July because of the introduction of what's called the UHR, UHR, which just means clock. And this was a box with a dial on it, which fitted into the plug board of the Enigma. On the front of the Enigma machine, there's 26 plugs connected by wires, usually 10 at a time, and these scramble the signal between the keyboard press and it going into the rotors. The UHR plugs into the plug board, and in position zero, it worked exactly like a regular plug board. No difference. In the other 39 positions it's capable of, it scrambles the setting.
So you turn the dial and you can immediately make your Enigma machine even more complex.
It's as if you could swap the cables around in all sorts of different ways at a moment's notice. And what it also allows is for the plug board to become non-reciprocal. You have normally cables with two plugs on either end. And this means that if an A turns into a Z will also turn into an A. And this is a really important feature of the Enigma, which the Bletchley Park codebreakers take advantage of by designing their bombs with a device called the diagonal board.
The diagonal board was invented by Gordon Welshman to adapt Turing's existing bomb design.
Yes, and the diagonal board makes use of this reciprocity in the plug board.
So it's a vulnerability of Enigma.
Absolutely. It's predictable. When the UHR is attached, in every fourth position, the plug board is still reciprocal. But in all the other positions, it's not. It's as if you'd connected A to Z, but then Z could go to B, and then B could go to another letter, and it completely scrambles the whole picture. The diagonal board on the bomb is now effectively useless.
So were the codebreakers at Bletchley Park able to read this traffic then, if it's so much more complex in a way that their bomb machines couldn't cope with?
They were. The messages have a number written out at the start. So it becomes quite apparent that the Germans are using a limited number of plug board combinations, because they never see a number higher than 39. So that indicates there's 40 positions if you include zero.
So the messages that they're reading is a number and then...
And then rubbish.
Right.
So they very quickly are able to work out what they're dealing with, which is something that scrambles the plug board settings. The fatal flaw with the UHR, as usual, is flaws in procedure, because the Germans recipher messages from the basic key using the UHR, and this allowed HUT-6 to work out the wiring of the UHR just by deduction. And then when the UHR is in use, they can recognise it in the messages and they can account for it and they can continue reading these keys. It's a problem that Bletchley Park overcomes actually pretty quickly, even though it could have been disastrous if the German procedures hadn't been flawed.
Was the Ur device fitted to all Enigma machines that the Germans were using?
At that point, it's only fitted to Air Force Enigmas. So Bletchley-Park can continue reading Naval Enigma, as they did before the invasion. They were reading about 1,300 messages a day. The naval element of the landings is still ongoing. The fleet has to be protected, and the Germans are trying to interdict the ships crossing the channel. Bletchley-Park reads an address from Admiral Dönitz on the night of June the 6th, which included the lines, "The enemy is at his weakest at the moment of the landing itself. In this early stage, everything must be concentrated on driving him back and inflicting losses, which will finally rob him of all desire to attempt further landings. Every enemy vessel concentrated in the landing is to be attacked under full operation, even at the risk of losing your own boat. Every man and every weapon destroyed before the landing decreases the enemy's prospects of success. For this I know I can rely on you, my U-boat men, who have proved your worth in the bitterest battles." So the Germans are going to flood the channel with U-boats and torpedo boats and everything else at their disposal to try and interfere with those fleet movements. Bletchley-Park's able to estimate the number of U-boats in the channel. They're able to keep an eye on the torpedo boats in the various ports. They're able to gauge the success of operations to take out those boats. So after one air raid, Bletchley noted that fewer boats left that particular harbour the day after. So they could work out that a certain number of ships had been hit by the air raid. And they also track the movement of German destroyers, which are coming up from the Bay of Biscay towards Normandy to try and interfere with the landings. And that allowed them to be attacked from the air and then intercepted and dispersed by Allied destroyers in the Battle of Ushant, which sunk two German destroyers and forced the other two to hide in Port of Brest, effectively took them out of the battle. And from naval ciphers as well, they get some information about the land fighting, because many of the crews of the coastal gun batteries are pressed into service as infantry as American forces close in on the Port of Cherbourg. And then they start talking about the land battle.
So in the way that in the lead up to D-Day, Bletchley-Park was using the information from signals in order to plan because it was aware of the German order of battle, this is an ongoing knowledge of the order of battle and how that's changing.
Absolutely.
General Bradley sends his infantry forward for the final penetration into Cherbourg. Sniper shooting in the streets of the city. The operation that has brought an investing force through the city ramparts will go down in history as one of the swiftest and most daring manoeuvres in the annals of the American Army. A small section of the 37,000-odd prisoners taken in the battle for Cherbourg. One of the last places to surrender was the arsenal. The final act of surrender takes place in a tunnel 30 feet underground when Lieutenant General Karl Wilhelm von Schlieben capitulates to General Collins. The American general receives the German garrison commander at his newly established headquarters. The interview is brief and to the point. So ends the second phase of the Allied invasion. General Bradley's message to the people of France is, here is your first large city to be returned to you.
And were they finding out about the land battle from the German army?
Well, German army keys are actually the least promising at this point. They are still reading them, but they're less forthcoming. The problem is that Bletchley-Park foresees that wireless traffic will explode after the invasion. Before the invasion, the German army is mostly using their landlines. But when they have to start moving around, they resort to the wireless. The problem is they also abandon their usual procedures. So Bletchley-Park has a lack of cribs. They don't know what these messages contain. And therefore, unless you can make a guess at what's in the message, you can't use your bomb machine to crack it. So it took several days before Hut 6 was able to break those keys.
So there's an increase in wireless traffic. Did that continue? Did that mean that there was more and more information?
It fluctuated because after the first few days of the invasion, the front line settles down, the landlines come back into use. As operations become more and more mobile later on, the wireless comes back into use.
And you can't break into a landline?
No.
This is intelligence from Enigma encrypted sources. What about signals that were encrypted with the Lorenz machine?
Yes, so the Lorenz machine is in use between von Rundstedt in Paris and the German High Command, and it's also used by Kesselring in Italy. It's been a very important source of intelligence in the run-up to D-Day.
This is the fish intelligence.
It's called fish, yes, and all the different links are named after different fish. So we have jellyfish in France, bream in Italy, and various others. So breaking a message involves working out the wheel settings and then working out the message settings. Unfortunately, from the 17th of June, the procedures change, and they change the settings on the Lorenz's wheels, not every month, but every day. And that gives Bletchley-Park a lot more work to do. David talked about this in last month's episode and about how it was broken by reprogramming Colossus. But in the meantime, the change largely shut Bletchley-Park out of fish traffic during the Battle of Normandy, and it later spread to other links and caused problems there as well. So after the change, jellyfish was read once in June, three times in July, and five times in August. And the Bream Link in Italy yielded 6 breaks in July, 6 in August. So they're not breaking it every day.
So what sort of information were they missing out on?
Well, actually, they're not missing out on that much because it takes several days at best to decrypt a phish message. So it's usually out-of-date information. It's usually high-level strategic information, which isn't of massive operational relevance when you're in contact with the enemy. The History of Hutfree says phish was strikingly non-operational and carried practically no tactical information. So it's not an enormous loss.
So the Enigma encrypted traffic is, at this stage, much more valuable.
Yes, because it relates to the flow of the battle on the ground.
Men of the French resistance movement come into their own. For years, they put up a noble fight behind enemy lines, looking toward the day of liberation. Now that great day has arrived. In a simple, though significant ceremony, the Cross of Lorraine is unfurled in the town square. Hearts swell with pride as civilians and military pledge anew their allegiance to those three great principles of the Republic. Liberty, equality, fraternity.
With this information, how does the battle unfold?
So, for the first couple of weeks, not an awful lot happens. The fighting is brutal, but it's quite low intensity because both sides are preoccupied. The Allies are trying to link up their beaches. The Germans are trying to form a coherent defence. The Allies are looking for opportunities to advance, though. They're well aware of the danger of stagnation. The Anzio landings that we talked about in a previous episode had shown how easily troops could be bottled up in a beachhead, and they didn't want that to happen in Normandy under any circumstances. This was recognised by Miles Dempsey, who commanded the British Second Army, and he said, "The landing at Anzio has shown that if our front remains stationary for a period of even 3 or 4 days, there is grave danger that it will congeal and that great difficulty will be experienced in breaking out. The problem of build-up, which immediately follows the assault in an invasion, precludes the possibility of a sustained and continuous assault. Main bodies must halt on bounds for periods of 3 or 4 days in order to allow sufficient strength to be built up." So that's exactly what happens in Normandy. In many ways, the battle is a race to build up forces. The Allies were hampered by the difficulty of landing troops on the beaches and all the supplies that they need to conduct the campaign, especially with the storm that struck on the 19th of June and destroyed the American Mulberry Harbour. There's limited shipping capacity and space, so supply dumps, maintenance depots, airfields, even roads have to be built to support the logistical effort. The Germans on their side of things were hampered by the Allied air attacks. Basically, any movement by day in the whole of France and northwest Europe by this point is liable to be attacked, and this slows down German movements considerably. The Germans also need to hold back forces at Calais because the deception campaign, Operation Fortitude, has still got them convinced that a second Allied landing might take place. What emerges is a situation where whichever side has forces to spare can launch an offensive. Montgomery, the British commander, knew this. So he aimed to make sure any German divisions which arrived were drawn into the fighting and damaged as quickly as possible so that they couldn't launch any counteroffensive. There's a lot of debate over whether this was Monty's intention from the start or whether it was a plan that emerged later.
Like a reactive strategy.
Like a reactive strategy. But what's certain is that his plan from quite early in the campaign is to pin the Germans down and let the Americans make the breakthrough. He wrote in his diary, "So long as Rommel has to use his strategic reserves to plug holes, we have done well." So in this strategy, ultra-intelligence is really vital because it can let Monty know when German forces are approaching the battlefront. And then as soon as they arrive, he can launch some sort of operation to draw them into the fighting and pin them down.
British tank units come out of the line for a well-earned rest after heavy fighting outside Caen. It was certainly great news when we heard that the 7th British Armoured Division, the Desert Rats, is in action in France. Battle-seasoned warriors of the British Army are to be found along many a Normandy road. There's not a thing about French roads that the old PBI can't tell you. And the Germans don't like it. They know to their cost what it is to come in contact with them.
After that initial phase of building up, the British launch a flanking move, Operation Perch. They perceive a gap in the middle of the German lines in central Normandy, and they send 7th Armoured Division, the famous Desert Rats, who had vast experience from the desert, and tries to flank the German line via Villers-Bocage. In the end, this effort fails. This is a famous engagement where the German Tiger Ace, Mikhail Wittmann, runs into the British forces in the village, takes them completely unawares, drives straight down the main street, shooting up supply vehicles, the command troop of the regiment in question. He drives past a tank which is aimed right at him, except the gunner isn't in the tank because he's gone to have a Jimmy Riddle around the back of some sheds. So Wittmann is able to cause significant damage and basically blunt the British attack. That's not quite the full story, because the rest of the Tiger unit is involved in heavy fighting throughout the rest of the day, and actually they lose quite a lot of tanks as well. It turns into a much larger struggle where the Germans actually come off quite badly. One motivation for Monty and Dempsey to call a halt to that effort is the fact that they know 2nd Panzer Division is nearing the front and they expect it to join the fight. This might actually have caused them to cancel the offensive too early, when more might have been achieved. So the next major offensive comes at the end of June. This is just after the Great Storm, so it's not ideal timing. The skies are overcast, so there's no Allied air support, and the supply effort has been hampered by the storm, so the Allied troops aren't as well equipped as they might have been. But because of Ultra, the British commanders know that 2nd SS Panzer Corps is approaching the front, and they need to get their blow in first. The operation which results is Operation Epsom, and this forces a salient in the German lines, which is known as the Scottish Corridor because the attacking division is the 15th Scottish. The aim is, again, to get round the flank of Korn and unhinge the German position. Like Perch, it falls short, but Montgomery maintained pressure and actually drew his troops back into better defensive positions in the expectation that 2nd SS Panzer Corps would have to intervene to shore up the German defences, and that's exactly what happens. So instead of launching a counterattack on their own terms, which can push the Allies back into the sea, the Panzer Corps attacks the newly created salient, and it's stopped dead by Allied artillery and also naval gunfire. And the Germans take very heavy losses, and that advantage they had by having divisions free to move around is squandered.
What were the other Allies doing at this point?
So the American forces are working to capture the Cotentin Peninsula and Cherbourg, and they achieve this relatively rapidly, so they've captured Cherbourg by the end of June. Unfortunately, the port's not usable because the Germans have done such a thorough job of destroying the facilities. And after that, the Americans are bogged down in what's called bocage, which is this terrain of small fields, very tall hedgerows surrounding them, sunken lanes, which is ideal defensive country for the Germans, and very, very tough for the attackers to move across. As soon as they move into a field, they can come under fire from three directions, from very well-concealed positions. So it's an absolute slog to work their way through it, and this takes the Americans some weeks to overcome.
Were the British struggling in the same way?
Well, the British did some fighting in the bocage country, but mostly the terrain over their side of the front is more open. It's still characterised by hedgerows and stone-built farms, which form quite good defensive positions. In some areas, which are some of the most heavily fought over, the land is actually very open, and this is as much of a problem as the bocage is, because open fields could be covered from a significant distance by German anti-tank guns, machine guns, mortars, while they remained in concealed positions to the rear. So the British by no means have an easy ride of it either. So you have a situation where the fighting degenerates somewhat into quite brutal, with attrition rates rivaling those of the First World War at times. It's highly unpleasant. In the early period, there's rain and mud. Later on, warm weather, heat and dust, which with the amount of animal and human remains around on the battlefield by that point, it does not make for a pleasant situation. And if you listen and read the accounts of the soldiers who were in Normandy, the smell is one of the things they remember the most vividly. It turns into a very unpleasant situation, and they're very, very relieved when it ends.
Sounds brutal.
It is very brutal. What exacerbates it is the nature of the opposition. Many of the German troops are SS. One division in particular, 12th SS, is the Hitlerjugend division. It's formed of young Nazis. They're young enough that they're given sweets in their ration rather than cigarettes. They're fanatical. A few days after the landings, they capture Canadian prisoners and end up lining them against the wall and shooting them. So there are war crimes on the German side from the early stages. And they have a tendency not to surrender and to go down fighting to the last man, or to feign surrender and then continue firing, tricks like that. So for fighting in Europe, it's about as brutal as it gets. The Germans are very concerned about Korn. They're concerned about not giving the Allies an easy route to Paris. And they knew that successes against the Americans meant nothing if the British and Canadians were able to get behind them. The British and Canadians are successful in drawing German forces in to fight them. So in the second half of July, the British and Canadians were facing 600 German tanks in 7 divisions. The Americans were only facing 100 tanks in 2 divisions. So the plan is working. The Germans by this point had taken around 116,000 casualties. The Allies had taken about the same number, but importantly, their losses were well within predictions, and they'd accounted for them, and they had reinforcements. On the other hand, the Germans had few reinforcements. Only about 10,000 reinforcements joined the battle, and so their units were quite literally being bled dry.
Berlin Radio says that Adolf Hitler has made another speech, this one on Friday, before a gathering of high party officials. The broadcast disclosed that Hitler, in appealing again for full party loyalty to himself, admitted that anti-Nazi generals had been sabotaging his regime ever since he came to power 11 years ago.
Last month, David spoke about how different Allied commanders reacted in different ways to ultra-intelligence on the Italian front. Was this a similar situation in Normandy?
Yeah, just like that. Different commanders have different approaches and different levels of trust in the information. Montgomery is actually quite unenthusiastic about ULTRA. Reportedly, according to Frederick Winterbottom, who set up the SEU-SLU organisation in the first place, Montgomery initially demanded sole control over the intelligence, and when he couldn't get it, his attitude became a bit cold to it. Monty still uses ULTRA extensively, and luckily his intelligence chief, Edgar Williams, better known as Bill Williams, was more open. He was a big fan of ULTRA, and he regarded it as a useful backup supply of information, and it challenged him and his team to beat it. They were trying to make their own intelligence assessments at the front, and ULTRA would either confirm or deny them, and if he could go to bed with the ULTRA having confirmed what he already suspected, he was happy. The fact Bill Williams is using ULTRA as a backup source of information, it doesn't indicate he didn't trust it, but it's actually a sensible scepticism. It's the right approach, because rather than being too dazzled by the authenticity of the intelligence and forgetting the context, he knows it's important to work out what it actually means as part of the big picture. And Montgomery's immediate subordinate, Miles Dempsey, is also a big fan of ULTRA. Completely sold on ULTRA, according to Winterbottom.
It's interesting that two people reporting to Montgomery were much more keen on it than Montgomery himself. When you were saying he wanted sole control over ULTRA, did he just want to be that single point of contact for the information?
This is quite typical of Montgomery's character, I think. He's quite arrogant. He's a big self-publicist. He likes the limelight and he likes to be in control of the situation. He's a micromanager and a perfectionist. So the idea that others had access to this information and could maybe question his decisions and challenge him because they were as well informed as he was something that he just didn't like. But as I say, that doesn't mean he doesn't use the ULTRA a lot, and his strategy is predicated on it.
What about the Americans? How did they see ULTRA?
The famous General Patton, with his pearl-handled revolvers, who comes into Normandy later on in the campaign, reportedly said to Winterbottom, "I don't need to hear about all this ULTRA, just tell my intelligence guys." He's far too much of a froster to actually get involved with the intelligence work himself, but he appreciates any knowledge about the Germans, anything that can let him give them a kicking. General Bradley, who's the other American army commander in Normandy, is quite sceptical of ULTRA, and he thought the Allies were too dependent on it. Again, he thinks there's more intelligence, there's a bigger picture, and it's too much of a risk to focus on one source of intelligence. And he'd had experience of the limitations of ULTRA in North Africa when it had predicted a certain German course of action which hadn't come true in reality. And Bradley wrote, "I did not embrace ULTRA as the Oracle of Delphi, but rather as a marvellous source of intelligence to be evaluated and used tactically with utmost care." So there's a similarity with Williams there, that he appreciates ULTRA, but only as part of the bigger picture.
ULTRA is British source intelligence. Did Americans have a similar kind of stream that they were more reliant on?
The Americans are receiving intelligence in exactly the same way the British commanders are. And it's an important part of inter-allied operations that they're receiving the same intelligence in the same way from the same source. And that's established quite early on. The Americans, cryptographically, they're making quite a big contribution to breaking Enigma because they have built a lot of bombs of their own. So a lot of the bomb work is being outsourced to Washington. But the actual organisation of disseminating that information in the West is from Bletchley Park and through the British organisation. So as a general rule, Bletchley Park is leading signals intelligence in Europe, and the Americans are leading signals intelligence in the Pacific. Although the Americans are contributing to Europe and Bletchley Park is contributing to the Pacific. I'd say arguably by this point, the generals are actually spoilt for intelligence because as well as ULTRA, they have all the other sources. They have such a complete picture of the German forces that they can almost take ULTRA for granted.
What other sources, for example?
Aerial reconnaissance, tactical Y, prisoner of war reports, patrolling. All of these tactical sources of intelligence that become available when the campaign unfolds. I'm not aware of any Allied general who completely turns their back on it.
Very important advances have been made all the way from the hinge of the Allied line south of Caen to the distant battlefield in Britain. Canadians and their comrades from the old country have been pushing the enemy back in spite of the most fierce and stubborn resistance. One of our latest film dispatches from this sector shows the guards advancing to clear the Germans out of a defensive position they'd been ordered to hold at all costs. guards cleared them out, and one more piece of French soil was cleansed of what Mr. Churchill called the filthy pollution of the Hun. Almost the whole front was on the move by now, and in many places the pace was very hot indeed. South and east, the Allies streamed through the breaches made in the Hun's lines. The German plan to contain the lodgement area in France had been smashed to pieces. The Hun had fled, leaving a great mass of equipment. Tanks, vehicles and guns. Vital equipment of every kind. Some of it simply abandoned in his hurry to get away, but most of it smashed by our own tanks, our own artillery, our infantry, and our typhoons. Very heavy losses, which Hitler's generals, those of them he doesn't hang, that is, can most certainly not afford to lose. At last, Hitler is being beaten in the field on every front, and his weapons that were to conquer the world, his weapons of destruction, are themselves being destroyed wholesale.
The Allies don't make significant progress on the ground until the end of July. So in the West, US forces in the Bocage had a grueling fight to capture the city of San Lo, which was achieved on the 19th of July. The day before, the British had launched a large armoured attack with all three of their armoured divisions around Caen, another flanking operation, codenamed Goodwood. Goodwood's been called the death ride of the armoured divisions, and it led to large losses of tanks, probably about 500. But the important thing to understand is in that offensive, the British had earned it with losses of machinery rather than blood. They're trying to preserve their troops, and losses among tank crews are much lower than losses among the infantry. Goodwood also achieved many of its objectives. It led to the final capture of Caen, and the British could finally see out into that open country to the south, which heralded the potential for much more fluid operations.
Canadian troops joined the main assault on the ancient city of Caen. Caen is an important military objective because of the strategic position it occupies. Its possession consolidates territory already held and frees the hands of the British Second Army for more open operations. Canadian troops play the leading part in one of the most massive assaults that Rommel has had to face in this war. Entering from the north, the onslaught carves its way right through Caen to the junction of the Odon and Orne rivers, due south of the town. Ruined buildings stand as evidence to the effectiveness of the naval support bombardment. The 16-inch guns of the battleship Rodney demolish entire enemy strong points. As the tide of battle moves forward, French civilians return to collect the salvage of their ruined homes. Life begins anew in battered Caen.
With all these operations happening, it doesn't seem to me that much progress is being made, geographically speaking.
Well, yeah, the Allies are still nowhere near Paris, even though it's late July. They're still only a few miles from the beach, but the important thing to understand is that the campaign was always going to require an attritional fight for several weeks or months before real progress was made. It wasn't going to be a sort of linear progression towards Paris. The Allies don't move 10% of the way to Paris in 10% of the time they've got. They have to draw the German forces in, pin them down, cause damage to them, cause casualties, wear them down, and that could take weeks or months. By the end of July, they are causing those casualties, the German forces are becoming more and more overstretched, and the Allies can look for opportunities for a breakout, which is exactly what happens. So on the 25th of July, the German position finally cracks with the US offensive, which is called Operation Cobra, which turns into the breakout. The British followed this up with an offensive of their own called Bluecoat, and both armies are now making good progress towards the south. General Patton's Third Army is activated on the 1st of August, and that can break out now into the interior of France. It liberates Brittany in the space of a few days and swings round south of the Germans, threatening to encircle them. Meanwhile, the British and Canadians are pushing south from Caen over that open country. They're still running into the teeth of pretty tough German defences because that's still where most German forces are concentrated. And the British and Canadians are actually learning their craft a little bit better at this stage. There's an operation called Totalize on the night of the 7th to 8th of August. It's a night march, and the attacking forces are formed into several armoured columns, which march into the darkness, following searchlights or tracer gunfire that's aimed over their heads. By the morning, they're 8 miles into the German lines, and they can then consolidate that position, and they're able to gain a big chunk of territory without taking awful casualties. So there are some really innovative ideas coming out of the British and Canadian side, especially the Canadian Corps Commander, General Guy Simmons, who's leading these operations.
World News Today, brought to you by shortwave broadcast direct from important overseas stations and leading news centres of our own country, CBS reporters are waiting to bring you first-hand news from the world's political and battlefronts. Now, here's Douglas Edwards.
American tanks and men are swarming across the Brittany Peninsula today, and the cleanup campaign has begun at Brest. Other American columns are turning eastward toward Paris. So now to CBS London, Richard C. Hotelet reporting.
In Brittany, there have been no new developments as far as we know.
Brest hasn't been taken, and it may be that the Germans will put up a stiff fight for it. Our combat teams are roaming the peninsula at will, it seems.
General Bradley is striking out in this new direction.
And it's important for several reasons. For one thing, it's another drive. It's not just a few half-tracks on reconnaissance patrol. We're moving on in strength.
This new movement shows that our command is quick on its feet and can change the direction of its thrust, always to go after the major objective. And that we've got the strength to spare for another independent operation. And that's another reason why this move eastward can be very important. For one thing, it's headed straight for Paris. But, much more immediately, if it continues, it can very well outflank the entire German Normandy front.
So by the start of August, the Germans are desperately fending off the British and Canadians south of Caen, but the Americans are sweeping round their flank. Typical reaction from Hitler at this point is to spot an opportunity, I put that in air quotes, to launch a counteroffensive. And he believed an armoured force could cut off the Americans at this quite narrow neck, I suppose, that they've formed near Avranches. If the German forces could reach the sea, they could cut off the US forces to the south and destroy them and then push the Allies back into the sea. Of course, this is fantasy. The Germans don't have the forces to carry this out. And actually, it has the potential to damage the German position even further because they're throwing their best armoured forces even deeper into this encirclement that's being created. But the attack does eventually go ahead. This is one of the clearest contributions of Ultra to the campaign. As German armoured divisions start to disengage from the forces they're facing and moving towards the west side of the salient and preparing to attack, this is all monitored by Bletchley Park. Now, General Bradley, who doesn't like Ultra very much, as we said, stated that he only received word about the attack on the 6th of August, which is 4 hours before it's about to happen, which is too late for him to make any preparations. But in fact, if you look at the decrypts, there's quite a lot of indications of what the Germans are up to. They haven't issued the order to attack, but they're organising their panzer divisions into a spearhead and they're calling on their air support, as usual, which has been picked up on the German Air Force networks. And it must have been apparent to Hut 3 what this meant for the situation in Normandy.
Apparent to Hut 3, but not apparent to Bradley?
Yeah, it seems maybe Bradley's intelligence staff weren't quite on the ball as they should have been, but the indications were certainly there. So the value of Ultra, as always, depends on what the customer's going to do with it and whether they're receptive to it and whether they're going to join the dots between the quite fragmented information you're getting to see the bigger picture. From Bletchley Park's perspective, they're able to give definite, albeit short-term, warning of the attack. So in the event this counteroffensive, which is known as the Mortain counteroffensive, does capture the town of Mortain, and it does threaten the US position momentarily, but it was piecemeal because the panzer divisions had to disengage from the forces they were facing and move straight into the attack, which is a nightmare situation for any soldier. One of the divisions doesn't even attack at all. They move overnight into areas which are poorly defended, but as soon as American resistance starts to stiffen the following day, the German offensive just stalls completely. As usual, Allied air power appears once the morning fog has lifted and they smash the German armoured columns on the roads and the offensive isn't going to go anywhere.
The Germans are trying to pull their forces out of the Allied trap in western France today. Since yesterday afternoon, German infantry, armour, motor, transport and horse-drawn equipment have been crowding the few remaining roads that lead out through the Falaise Gap. Something like 100,000 men and several hundred tanks are trying to get out. And all this time, during every hour of daylight, these choked roads have been bombed, machine-gunned, and hit by the rockets of all the medium and fighter bombers we could put into the air. Correspondents at the front have described the bombs cascading down from planes glistening in the sun. And the Germans' only protection has been the dust of their escape. Meanwhile, the gap through which the Germans are trying to escape is being narrowed down. There are now only about 30 miles of escape gap left for the Germans, and we can be sure that it's in the process of being narrowed down right now.
Did Ultra Intelligence have any further contributions to the Normandy campaign, or was this its kind of peak?
As the German position in Normandy is collapsing, the Allies also invade southern France. This is Operation Anvil, as we talked about in last month's episode, but by the time it's launched, it's actually called Operation Dragoon. Ultra had failed to demonstrate quickly enough that the Germans weren't intending to fight for southern France, but it was able to give prompt notice of their withdrawal when they decided that they were going to retreat to eastern France and form a new defensive line on the Swiss border. So no time was lost in pursuing the German forces. Ultimately, about 130,000 German troops are captured. That's more than in Normandy. As usual, Bletchley Park are able to provide really useful sort of strategic order of battle information about the movements of German formations, which helps the Allied troops as they push north.
The Germans this evening report that American tanks are across the Seine River after airborne and parachute troops had established a bridgehead somewhere between Vernon and Mont. The enemy says that heavy fighting is in progress at this point. A Reuters correspondent said that American forces were stretched out along the west bank of the river for miles north of Nantes.
The Allies complete their encirclement on the 19th of August. There is very heavy fighting, especially involving the Polish Armored Division, which has plugged the gap as the Germans counterattack to break their way out of the encirclement. The Falaise pocket is finally sealed on the 21st of August, with around 50,000 German troops captured. So the shattered German forces are now streaming back towards the German border and the Low Countries. The Allied forces don't wait around, they're advancing full pelt after them. The British 11th Armored Division advances 250 miles in 6 days from Normandy to northern Belgium. So the Allied advance is actually significantly faster than the famous German Blitzkrieg of 1940.
Columbia's shortwave listening station here in New York heard a British broadcast report that General de Gaulle, accompanied by General Alphonse Juin, has arrived in Cherbourg. There have been reports during the week that de Gaulle would join the first American forces to enter Paris.
The Germans don't defend Paris. It's declared an open city, and there is an uprising by French resistance in Paris, and it's finally liberated by Allied forces on the 25th of August.
Here is the news, read by Richard Wessel. Paris has been liberated. A communique just received from General Koenig announces that it has been liberated by French forces of the interior.
Marvelous sights I've ever seen coming down the boulevard into the heart of Paris. Everywhere we went, people came running out of their houses, out of the shops, shaking hands with us. Children were held up to us to be kissed, and they clung around our necks. People were giving us flowers, tomatoes, everything. It's been the most marvelous procession I've ever seen. Here they are, they're just mad with joy. Just listen to these crowds.
This episode is called 90 Days. Would you call the Normandy campaign a success?
Yes, it was undeniably a success. The Allies had achieved their objective ahead of schedule. They'd liberated Paris short of 90 days, and they'd done it with fewer losses than they were forecasting as well. A landing operation of that sort had the potential to bog down in the same way that Anzio had done, and that didn't happen. The Allies were able to keep the initiative, keep the German forces overstretched, foresaw any counteroffensive. A lot has been said about the poor performance of the Allies in Normandy, but we need to remember they are on the defensive pretty much all the time. And very little attention is paid to when the Germans try to counterattack, because when they do, they invariably fail, because attacking is difficult whichever side you're on. In the end, the Allied troops have shown themselves to be the equal or better than the Germans, hands down, and they've delivered a significant defeat.
Generals now turn to face the square in this huge crowd of Parisians. He's being presented to people. He's being received. Even while the general is marching into the cathedral. Well, that was one of the most dramatic scenes I've ever seen. Just as General de Gaulle was about to enter the Cathedral of Notre Dame, firing started all over the place. I'm afraid we couldn't get you the noise of that firing because I was overwhelmed by a rush of people who were trying to seek shelter
and my cable parted from my microphone. But I fell just near General de Gaulle, and I managed to pick myself up. General de Gaulle was trying to control the crowds rushing into the cathedral. He walked straight ahead into what appeared to me to be a hail of fire from somewhere inside the cathedral, somewhere from the galleries up near the vaulted roof. But he went straight ahead without hesitation, his shoulders flung back, and walked right down the central aisle, even while the bullets were pouring around him.
And what would you conclude about Bletchley Park's role?
Bletchley Park's very important throughout. The Allied strategy that relies on pinning down those German units couldn't have worked as well as it did without knowledge of where those units were and when the reinforcements would arrive. Ultra's usefulness is mostly strategic rather than tactical, but it does have its tactical moments, such as at Carentan and Mortain. Overall, it's a success. Bletchley Park can't rest on their laurels, though, because for them the job is only going to get harder, because the improvements in German procedure, which start during the Battle of Normandy, are going to become more severe later on. And similarly, for the Allied troops on the ground, the German army may seem on the verge of collapse, but far from it. It will recover. The campaign is far from over, and there's going to be much hard fighting. It's going to be able to put up stout resistance in the Low Countries and along the German border, which is going to lead to much hard fighting before the war is finished.
This is Matthew Halton of the CBC, speaking from Paris, about our entry into the town yesterday, and I don't know how to do it. Yesterday was the most glorious and splendid thing I've ever seen. The first French and American patrols got into the outskirts of Paris the night before last. Yesterday morning the soldiers were coming in force. I came in with them, with French troops. We came in from the south, along the Avenue de l'Italie. For hours, we had strained our eyes for the first sight of Paris. And then, suddenly, there it was, the most beautiful city in the world, and the people surging into the streets in millions. I don't know how we got along those streets. We were among the first vehicles, and the people just went mad. We drove for miles, saluting with both hands, and shouting Vive la France till we lost our voices. Every time we stopped for a second, girls pressed round the jeep to kisses, and to inundate us with flowers. But, as we drove along the Boulevard Saint-Germain toward the river, and the bridge leading to the Place de la Concorde, the crowds thinned out because there was fighting just ahead in the Chamber of Deputies. There was machine gun fire, rifle fire by German snipers, and an occasional shot from a tank. For half an hour we watched the fighting. Then I asked a policeman how I could get round the fighting and across the river to the opera and the center of the city. The gendarme at once telephoned to the Mackie. Three people of the Mackie came and got me. Two young men and a beautiful girl, an actress. They broke into tears when they saw I was Canadian, and they kissed me 20 times. Then they took me in their car, and we drove through the wildly cheering crowds with our arms round each other. We crossed the river to the Ile de la Cité, the cradle of Paris history, and passed Notre Dame, and then up the Avenue of the Opera to the Scribe Hotel. Here the crowds were just beginning to come into the streets, mad with happiness. My friends were shouting, Il est Canadien, he's a Canadian. And I knew what it was to feel like a king.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.